broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
Steam echoes off blue and yellow tiles. Rivulets stream down walls. Roofs, oculus, opens to Turkey's hot sky. We have this round room to ourselves. We dip ladles into heated pools, then tepid, like a finished sauna, but inside in summer. My feet appear, disappear in clouds. Our red checkered pestamals like Kafaya, like Arafat wore, wet as puddles. A man enters. I lie down. He folds my hands over my heart. He washes me with huge towel-covered hands. Suds fly everywhere, like blowing bubbles. He and I laugh. Then he washes my face. No one has ever washed my face except my parents. I remember crossing my mother's hands over her chest after the end, seeing my father's hands crossed by someone else. My bones sharp against the tiles. All liquids have escaped me. I've never been so thirsty or so clean. We dress to the muezzin's afternoon call to prayer. Outside I hear seagulls, smell the Aegean, then the Baltic. You take photographs of me at the hammam entrance. Later I notice how sunken, how hollow-cheeked I look. Everything sucked out of me. Bodrum Hammam by Catherine Gecker, published in the Delmarva Review, Volume 11. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. One of the beauties of poetry is that if the reader or listener is open to it, wonderful hidden things are revealed. Memories we thought long buried. Feelings, both welcome and unwelcome. And if it is good poetry, we are exposed, naked even, not to the world, but to ourselves. This is because in its narrative, in its tone, and particularly in its imagery, feelings are emoted, and questions are asked. Questions we are asked, and questions we must ask ourselves. So again, if it is good poetry, nothing is ever finalized. There is always a subtlety, an obscurity that harbors the questions. In this sense, poetry, like most great literature, is incredibly personal, directed to each individual reader and listener. In her poem, Bodrum Hammam, poet Catherine Gecker takes us into a Turkish bath, where it is so wet that water streams down its blue and yellow walls, and our red checkered towels are soaking wet from the saturated air. Hot, then tepid water is dipped from a pool in a ritual of self-cleansing, a personal baptism, if you will, of washing away the outer world. And then the narrative in the poem shifts from we to I, and the other enters the room. I lie down. He folds my hands over my heart, Gecker says. He washes me with huge towel-covered hands. This innocent washing is a delight, and there is laughter and flying soap suds. Then the washing of her face by the other reminds her of her parents, who were the only others who ever washed her face, and she remembers their death and the crossing of their arms as part of the preparation for burial. And suddenly we realize that this entire poem, the self-cleansing, the folded arms, the washing, is a prelude for burial. When the bath has ended, photographs are taken in the street outside the bath, and even though she can smell the sea, everything has changed. In the photograph, she notices how sunken and hollow-cheeked she looks now, as though everything has been sucked out of her. What has changed here? And what questions are we asked by this poem? And what questions must we ask ourselves? Catherine Gecker is my guest today, and we'll ask her these questions in a bit as we discuss the poetry in her new book, In Search of Warm Breathing Things. Catherine, welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition.
Thank you, Hal. I'm delighted to be here.
Catherine, I know that you're a musician and that you founded and ran a commercial printing company for 31 years. In addition to that, however, you found time to be nominated for the Pushcart Prize and the Best of the Net Prize for your poetry. When did you begin writing poetry, and how in the world did you find time?
That's a good question. As serious as anybody can be when one is a teenager, I became serious about writing sometime around 15 or 16. And it is poetry that brought me to printing. When I was in graduate school, two fellows and I published for 1 year a literary magazine through our university.
What and university was that, Catherine?
That was the University of Virginia. I was in the very first class of women at the University of Virginia. There were 160 of us out of 12,000 students who were legally permitted to enter the university. This was in 1970. We were the transfer students. There were 1,000 first-year women who were allowed to come in at that same time. But our class, 1972, was the first class there. As someone once told my mother, "Oh, your daughter's historic." The poetry that we published and fiction that we published in that literary magazine intrigued me. The selection of those, the interviews with some famous poets. And I thought, I'd like to publish poetry. And the more research I did, the more I thought, I could do that. I became intrigued with Leonard and Virginia Woolf's publishing venture, and William Morris's arts and crafts movement. I wanted to print on with a letterpress press where the type is actually bitten into the paper, where you can see the relief of the words, the letters.
You can feel it?
You can feel it. And that intrigued me no end. So when I finished school, I started a little printing company in a back bedroom. What I learned in that first year or two was that two valuable lessons. One is publishers need to have money, and I didn't.
Who were your clients, though?
Well, all you need to do is say, I'm interested in publishing poetry, and boy, do they come out of the woodwork. Some very good, some not so good, but a lot of people approached me. I also realized that not only didn't I have the money to do publishing, I wasn't as interested in putting my attention on other people's work as I was on putting it on my own work, selfish as that might sound. So I became a commercial printer. And in the 31...
Not in your back bedroom.
No, after that first year, I started moving into real space. But I operated on my own for the first, I'm going to guess roughly a year and a half or so before I was able to start hiring people. In those 31 years, Hal, I started in letterpress. And at the end, I had one of the very few digital presses on the East Coast. So in 31 years, we were a snapshot of the last 600 years of technology and printing.
And you watched the change to digital take place as
Yes,
well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So on your literary magazine, who were the submitters? Were they primarily students, or were you getting work from all over?
Both. It was primarily students, but also visiting poets would submit as well. Diane Wachowski was a poet at the university for that, maybe that whole year, but at least for one semester. She gave us some poems. We interviewed Gary Snyder. We had a lot of well-known poets coming through. It was lovely. I got to meet Elizabeth Bishop. She was quite diminished by then.
Is that literary magazine still being published at the university?
No, we were the birth and the death of it.
You were the beginning and the end.
That's correct.
Well, I know that you're from Arlington, and I also know that you're very active in the writing community in Rehoboth. How do you make that work? Tell me about your participation in the Rehoboth writing community and a little bit about the Rehoboth writing community itself.
I'll tell a story. The Rehoboth Beach Writers Guild, the executive director is Mary Beth Fisher. Mary Beth has built an incredibly vibrant community of writers in the Rehoboth-Lewis area, predominantly in that area. Once a month, there's a night of songs and stories, and people read 300 words or fewer, and there are some performers who do music as well. The very first time I read was as I recall, it was a very bleak, cold February evening at the old Dogfish Head, before they put up the new one. And it was up the street from me, so I walked up there, and I was the only person walking in all of Rehoboth Beach, I'm sure of it. When I got inside, and I thought, who's going to be there? I didn't know many people at that time. When I got inside, I was astounded. On a Tuesday night in February, there were 150 people there gathered to hear poetry, short fiction, short memoir, and listen to music. The Rehoboth Beach Writers Guild has workshops, free writes, classes. It has a morning of art where you write to certain art pieces that are projected, and of course this monthly reading series. It's a very vibrant community with a lot of talent.
What role do you play in that community, Catherine?
I'm just a member.
Do you read?
Yes, I do. I've not been able to be in Rehoboth as much this past year with the book coming out as I like to be, but I hope once I get through these next few months that I can be there more often again and participate.
But you're also a musician. And tell us a little bit about your musical work. And you mentioned in Rehoboth that music is used at the poetry readings and the literary readings. Do you do anything with your music in that venue?
You have given me a very great compliment, which I shall never forget. I am a piano student.
Oh, okay.
I wouldn't call myself a musician, but thank you. I am a devoted student, and I practice every day.
And but you don't perform in public at this point, or you do?
Only for my recital with my piano teacher's adult students, okay. And that kind of thing. We perform once a year for judges.
Well, the poem I opened with, Bagram Hammam, was published in the Delmarva Review a couple of years ago. And in reading your new poetry book, I noticed the poem Day of Beauty and Facial. And it struck me the similarity between the two poems. And I wondered if you would read Day of Beauty, Facial, for us and talk a little bit about it.
Thank you, yes. Day of Beauty, Facial. The attendant knots a towel around my face to hold my chin and hair in place, like the towel the nurses wrapped around my mother's face to keep her jaw from dropping, as if we cared about that. The attendant crosses my hands on my chest, wraps a blanket around me, like the sheet the nurses wrapped around my mother after they crossed her hands on her chest. So she looked like she was praying, as if they needed to make her presentable, as if she weren't already beautiful, her face thin like a girl's. When they brought the gurney to take my mother away, we all helped wind her into that sheet and finally covered her face, so we never saw her again, so that the last touches she had were from those she loved. Today, the attendant wraps me and turns me and touches me, tells me, this is a day of beauty. The face. Is there anything more intimate than touching another person's face? For most of us, it begins when our parents, if we're lucky enough to have loving parents, will wash or caress our faces. As children, we might caress our parents' faces. As adults, lovers will caress our faces, or children might caress our faces.
I find that children do, in fact, love to... I don't mean to interrupt you here, and I'm sorry for that, but I do find that children, babies and young children, love to touch your face.
They do, and it's a very sweet gesture, isn't it? I find it...
It is.
It's so touching and loving. There's another group of people that sometimes we'll ask to touch our faces. The visually impaired sometimes will say, may I touch your face while you're speaking, or may I touch your face in order to know you. The face is the thing we remember when someone is gone. It's how we recognize each other. It is what makes us human, our faces. We might forget a voice, but we don't forget faces. So that is part of it, I think. The other thing is, in both poems, I refer to crossing arms. And in certain religious traditions, arms are crossed to pray. So I wanted to reflect that as well.
Your mother appears in both of these poems. Mm-hmm. The death of your mother appears. Tell us about your mother.
I was very lucky with both parents. My father died in 1971, many, many years ago, and my mother died 13 years ago. We were a close family, and I grew up learning to love language, words. There were many languages spoken in my home. Of course, English, French, German, Russian, some Swedish.
Where did the knowledge of all these languages come from?
They were European, and like many Europeans, can speak a number of languages. And they used to always say, if you start early enough, it's not so hard. here in the U.S., we don't have to learn languages. But in Europe, if you go 100 miles, you might need a whole different language in order to communicate. So
your parents were immigrants?
It's a more complicated story, but yes, my father was. My mother only moved to the U.S. In her teens. She was born a U.S. citizen, but had never been here until she was in her teens.
Where was she born?
She was born in Düsseldorf, Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in 1924. And then in 37, the Americans were, families were brought out of Germany because of the rise of Hitler. And, well, he'd already risen, but because of the danger. And they, her family sent her to a boarding school in Brussels. And then a few years later, in 39, they came here to Washington, D.C., where I was eventually born.
Did you pick up any of those languages other than English, Catherine? We know your English is very good.
Thank you. Well, it's sort of like calling me a musician. I can get by, but just barely.
Well, I found both of these poems really fascinating, and particularly the washing and the wrapping, and it took me, I'm a little slow, but it took me a bit to realize that Bagram Hammam is really a poem about preparation for burial. At least I saw it as that. And then this poem is more clearly preparation for burial. So both poems, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, both poems here are a very touching and personal way of saying goodbye.
I think so, and thank you. I wanted them to be touching poems. One of the things that surprised me in writing the Bodrum Hammam poem was the same thing that surprised me when I was in the hammam. You think you're in a place and getting a Turkish bath, and someone touched my face, and all of a sudden I was 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 again.
And you remembered. And you remembered your mother.
Yes.
Yeah. This next poem I'd like for you to read is entitled Sweet Chocolate. And that is also an incredibly touching poem. And I wish you would read that for us, if you don't mind.
Yes, I'd love to read this poem. And this is also about my mother. Sweet Chocolate. They said there'd be chocolate, you tell me on the last day you are able to speak. Your eyes widen, look deliberately at the table where they leave your meals. You are too weak to move your head. Stopped chewing weeks ago. No longer swallow. Nurses swab morphine inside your mouth. I no longer eat either, but before leaving home this morning, I put 5 Hershey's Kisses in my purse. So I say, they are right. There is chocolate. I place one morsel in your mouth. After a long time, your thin neck swallows. Your last meal. Your eyelids close slowly, carefully. That is how you thank me. After a while, you say, if I'm smiling the next time you see me, you'll know what has happened.
What is the background for this poem, and what are you creating here?
My mother had died of cancer. And as with many cancer deaths, was in pain at the end, and it took longer than she wanted it to. I remember a few months before she died, she said, oh, I waited too long to go to Holland. And why can't we be as kind to each other as we are to our dogs? Hmm. She was peaceful about dying, although it was painful. And she loved sweets. So it was a very sweet last moment that she was able to speak. And I was so grateful I had a Hershey's Kiss or two in my purse. She was only able to do one. And she couldn't chew. She had to wait for it to melt. So she eventually, I could see that she swallowed it. While I often use a lot of fiction in my poems, this is a very accurate depiction of that event.
In reading both, I keep coming back to the Bagram Hammam. You can tell it touched me very deeply. But I noticed about that poem, and then about this one. At least for me, I got the sense that there is a bit of religious ritual that comes out at me from here. Number one is the baptism, and I called it that when I talked about the poem, the dipping and the pouring water over, maybe almost a symbolic cleansing. And then here, I was thinking about, quite frankly, the wafer in the Catholic Church being placed in the mouth, and it's not chewed. I'm not Catholic, but I understand it is not chewed. It melts. And here is kind of a number of different kinds of communion. There is a communion between you and your mother, and kind of playing the priest. You place the chocolate in her mouth, and at the end, this poetry, I said at the beginning, is incredibly personal, and this poem, your poems, become very, very personal for me. So I'm wondering if there is any sense of your own mind of the religious ritual aspect that at least I pulled from these poems.
You are such a careful and wise reader of poetry, Hal. One of the tools I think I like to use in my poetry toolbox is the archetype. So the Western tradition, the Christian tradition, even if you're not Christian, you know these, like you said, you're not Catholic, but you know about the wafer, and you know that you don't chew it. It's not my tradition either. Many religious practices include a cleansing of the self before praying, in Islam as well. Even if you don't have access to water, there's the motion of cleansing. So those are archetypes, and I'll use anything I can to try to help connect with the reader and make things more powerful and, as you said, more emotional.
Well, you open the world to us, and that is what this does. Well, let me shift gears a little bit here, Catherine. A couple of your poems have been set to music, I understand, and we have the musical version of one of your poems here, and I would like to play that. But first, I'd like for you to read the poem, if you don't mind, and after you read the poem, we'll listen to the musical version of this piece. The poem is Overnight Maples Turn Into Pumpkins. Would you read that poem for us?
Overnight maples turn into pumpkins, and the dog disappears for hours in his leaf-filled yard. Herds squirrels corner to corner. No acorn will be harvested on his watch. Too tired for his nighttime walk, he puts himself to bed at 8. Tonight as the sun sets, wasps race to their nest, angry that their time is almost over. 7 deer tiptoe single file from their feeding ground to their sleeping ground. A full moon shines silver on the batwing begonias. And then it happens. You are there. The dog, overjoyed, brings his ball, his stick, anything to keep you. It's like that other sunset. For a long time, you had been too ill to look out the window. Suddenly, you saw the tops of the oaks. They glowed yellow. You asked, "How can I bear such beauty?"
It's like that other sunset.
Catherine, incredibly moving, just beautiful. I hate to ask it in such a straightforward manner, but who are these people who are performing your poem, and how did this come about?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because I do want to acknowledge these incredible performers. Carson Kooman, C-O-O-M-A-N, is the composer of this piece, and it's called Chasing the Moon Down. It's a four-part set of poems, and this is the final one, the one you just heard. The beautiful mezzo-soprano Katarzyna Sendej sings the words. The pianist is Jeffrey Grossman. And the trumpeter is my brother, Chris Gecker. Chris is a trumpeter with an international reputation. Composers all over the world compose pieces for him. And he has been a lifelong supporter, unwavering supporter of me, and probably my earliest fan for my writing. He was in school at Eastman School of Music, and one of his dearest friends there is the composer Eric Uwaisen. And I'm going to guess roughly 30 years ago, Chris showed Eric a few of my poems, because he would always ask me to send some, and I did. And Eric said, gosh, do you think your sister would let me set some of these to music? So that was the first time it happened. And that was a series of 8 poems that Eric wrote, and it's called To Cast a Shadow Again. And that was an incredible experience to hear that played the first time. I kind of forgot I had written those words, because it takes a number of years. And then to hear the recording eventually, but first to hear it live. The baritone, William Sharp, was the voice for that first recording of it. A number of years later, Carson Kooman contacted me and said, I'm a fan of To Cast a Shadow Again. Do you have any other poems? And I thought, gosh, you know, I do have this seasonal cycle, winter, spring, summer, fall, that I've been working on. And I sent it to him after checking with my brother. Do you know this composer? And Carson very kindly sent me some of his work, which I liked a great deal. And Chris liked it a lot. So I said, yes, how about this? And I knew that he wanted to write it for Chris. I was very happy with this piece. Those final chords just echo throughout me. And Hal, I was able to be there at the recording session, which was a first for me. What a thrill that was. So that's how that happened.
Well, it's available, I understand, on iTunes. So how does one access it on iTunes?
Carson Kooman would be the way to look for it. C-O-O-M-A-N. Carson is the first name. Or you could look by title, which is Chasing the Moon Down. And the other composer is Eric, E-R-I-C, Uwaisen, E-W-A-Z-E-N. And that is called To Cast a Shadow Again. And both of those are available on CD, the old-fashioned technology, as well as iTunes.
Well, your work is incredibly moving, and the work on that music is very moving as well. But we're going to change a little bit, and we're going to go to another mood now. And that mood actually, I find quite interesting. That mood is anger. And it's couched in grammar's emotional rules, you call them. So read, please, grammar's emotional rules, and talk to us about the meaning of anger and how it got embedded in this grammar's emotional construct.
Grammar's emotional rules. 1. Progressive forms, adjectives, and adverbs. Angry, angrier, angriest. Positive, comparative, superlative forms. Example, I'm positively angry that you don't pay attention to me. Always use comparatives and superlatives with care. Example, I'm comparatively angrier day by day because you go out drinking. Example, I'm superlatively the angriest I've ever been because you just called me that awful word because I just called you a drunk. 2. Misplaced limiting modifiers. Just is a limiting modifier. Anger can be just. Example, just anger as in simple anger as in I'm just angry that you drink every night. Or just anger as in righteous anger as in I'm joining the Women's Temperance Society because people like you are ruining my life and the lives of others. Misplaced anger is never a misplaced modifier. Anger is difficult to modify. Anger can be limiting, but do not limit your anger. You should limit your drinking, but I'm allowed to be as angry as I want. 3. Count and non-count nouns, both proper and common. Anger counts always. Anger can be proper if you don't become a harridan. If you become a harridan, anger is common. Anger always arrives in degrees, but anger is not always positive. I exceed all others in anger. I am positive about that.
Catherine, in reading this poem and in listening to it, I get the sense that a lot more is said by this poem than the words indicate. What is the background of this poem? Or let me ask it another way. Where in the world does this poem come from? And what kind of anger allowed you to sit down and say, all right, I think you must have broken the pencil lead 4 times writing this piece. So tell us a bit about this poem.
It has a very plain beginning. A number of years ago, I taught composition at Northern Virginia Community College. And because I taught the remedial version of it, often these were students who didn't do well in high school English or composition classes, and many of the students were students for whom English is not their first language. So I taught a lot of grammar, and grammar has changed since I learned grammar, and I probably hadn't studied grammar since I was in high school. So I had to learn all new things and new language, like count and non-count nouns and comma splices. So I became a student of grammar again, which I've always loved. My parents loved grammar. So I grew up knowing about it before I even studied it in school. So that's the genesis of the form. Anger is an uncomfortable emotion, both for the people receiving anger as well as the person who is angry. And I think particularly for women, it's difficult to own anger. We're taught to be ladylike. We're taught to not show anger. In this poem, it's about a partner suffering from drink, from alcohol, and the narrator in the poem is suffering from anger. So both the narrator and the object of the anger are suffering.
Does this come out of your personal life?
This is very much fictionalized.
Okay.
But I was married to someone who suffered from alcohol, not to the degree that I'm talking about here. Most of the examples here are very much made up.
Did you suffer from anger to the same degree?
I think I still suffer from anger, but I suffer from many things, including, sloth on the days that I don't write.
Don't we all? No, that's right. Well, I want to turn to another poem that is a little similar to this. Only we're going to talk about numbers here. Look at The Look at Numbers Theory is the name of the poem. And read Numbers Theory for us.
Numbers Theory. 1. Odd, even. 1 is odd. 13 is odd. 137 is odd. 1370 is even. 0 equals nothing. Nothing is even. What is even stays even. What is odd stays odd. Except when zeroed. Zero makes everything even. 2. Addition, subtraction. Addition, numbers combine to increase value. Subtraction, numbers combine to lose value. Addition or subtraction equal change, more or less. Except zero adds nothing, and zero subtracts nothing. Nothing from nothing leaves nothing. 3. Numbers, people. People can be even. For instance, you and I together are even. People can be odd. For instance, you and I and that other person equal odd. People add themselves or take themselves away. People cannot be zero, except when someone becomes zero. That always follows subtraction. 4. Numbers, place. Our street number is 1370. Is our house on the even or odd side of the street? See section 1, odd, even. 5. Answers. We live on the even side of the street, although, oddly, you are no longer there. So, we are no longer even together. Therefore, I am now one, alone, and thus odd in more ways than numbers can count.
Are you odd, Catherine?
Oh, I'm trying to own it as I get older, let's just say that.
No, I don't think so. This is a delightful piece of work. I think you almost have to see it and watch these numbers change. But I love the rhythm and the working with the numbers is quite delightful. And it's interesting to me that we only know who we are in relationship to others. And so as a result, when we are subtracted from others, I think we definitely become odd, because then we no longer know who we are, because we don't have the other to...
You're right. And you had said to me a while ago that so much of this book is about separation.
Yes, and this definitely is about separation. Well, I want to go to one more poem that struck me particularly because it speaks of a time that was most impressionable for me, and that is the 1960s, and. And 1969, and the events of the 60s, which were very much a part actually of my life. But read for us, please, Vietnam Summer Friends, 1969.
Vietnam Summer Friends, 1969. That summer's pet, a wide-mouth bass, its fat shadow darted toward the dock, ate worms from our hands, while we waited for AJ to ship out to Vietnam. AJ drove fast, too close to parked cars, trees. Addie and I were frightened. An X-rated foreign movie came to town. AJ and Addie wanted to see it. I asked my parents, is it okay? You're old enough to decide yourself, they said. Addie and AJ and I held hands in the dark. For a long time afterward, we couldn't call each other. That winter, Addie turned strange. She complained, "A stegosaurus crushes my chest, won't let me out of bed. There's a whole herd of them at our old elementary school." My childhood dog died. My father entered the last year of his life. Army doctors shipped AJ home. I held his hand as he told me. Something exploded, and when I came to, I was screaming. A log covered with flies was near me. It was my leg. Today I visit the lake. A gentle rain crawls across it, a migration of water bugs. I dangle my hand under the surface, long for that shadow to nibble my fingers again.
Tell us about this poem, Catherine.
It's about becoming an adult, about that moment which, in one moment, you're holding your hand in this idyllic, bucolic moment, feeding a trained wide-mouthed bass. And the next moment, the world is crashing around. Vietnam is happening. You aren't even sure if you would be allowed to see an X-rated movie. By the way, that was the Swedish movie, I Am Curious Yellow.
Oh, yeah.
Probably wouldn't be considered X-rated now, but anyway. And all of a sudden, everything changes. Death began to haunt. It's that moment.
Did you have friends who went to Vietnam?
Certainly, yes.
Did you have friends who didn't come back from Vietnam?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I had friends who did everything to avoid going, including one young man who took me out for coffee one day, and I didn't even know his name, and he gave me a ring, and he said, "Let's get married so I don't have to go to Vietnam."
I said this was a very impressionable time for me, and I remember all of this. I remember this period. I knew the kids who went to Canada instead of going to Vietnam, and at the same time, I knew friends who stood in the crowd and burned their draft cards during that period. And I remember the marches we did, and the anti-war rallies in Boston Common when the war was in full swing. And remember the friends I had who died over there. And it was it's amazing that it was a very, very painful time, but an incredibly creative time here. It was.
I don't know that I would have come up with that word creative, but you're right. Young people were seeking new ways to be heard and were taking responsibility for being heard.
Well, and then there was the whole civil rights movement, the feminist movement. That was incredibly, don't you think that was incredibly creative?
Absolutely.
On the other side of the Vietnam War.
I think also there was the recognition that Vietnam soldiers and sailors, it was a class division. So if you could go to college, if you had access to other resources, you didn't have to go. It struck rural and poor communities, and they were decimated, some of them. And it took a long time for us to realize how badly that had happened and the impact of that.
Catherine, we've got a few minutes left. Let me ask you about the volunteer work. The volunteer work that you're doing in the hospitals in the D.C. area, if you would, and how that relates to your poetry.
A young man named Frankie Aberlind, who is the son of two people I knew in college, friends of mine, started a an organization called the Good Listening Project. The mission is to improve healthcare outcomes through good listening. We sit in hospitals at a table with an old manual typewriter and a sign that says free custom poetry. Patients, caregivers, and staff choose to sit down with us and tell us what's on their mind or what they might like a poem about. And then we type up a poem for them and send it, take a photo of it and send it to them, generally within 24 to 48 hours. And it's quite an experience, and it's a very different experience than writing poems for oneself.
Do you have an example of a poem that you wrote?
I do have one. I'll just say briefly, this woman came dashing up to the table. She said, I only have a minute, and I'm a poet too. And she recited a poem of her own that included...
Was she a patient?
Yes, she was, yes. And I titled the poem Stage 4 Poetry.
Ooh.
I write reality poetry, cocaine, drug dealing, guns, war. But today I'd like a poem about cancer, about my stage 4 cancer. My treatment is working. I've just moved up here to undergo further treatment. I'm staying with my sister. It's my first time here. What do I write about now? I'm writing prayerful poems.
Catherine, you had mentioned when we chatted once before that this was a healing activity, not a curing activity, but a healing activity. What do you mean by a healing activity?
Often when someone sits down and we say our first prompt is usually, what would you like a poem about today? And there might be a long silence. Often they get choked up. Often tears will come streaming down their cheeks. They might not be able to speak for quite a while. Simply asking the question is healing, apparently. And then we listen. And that is healing. And often they get up and they say, thank you so much for listening. And this has been so valuable. And then we get incredible responses after we send them the poems. It's a very positive experience. We don't cure, but apparently, at least for those moments, we heal. And that's a lot of good that's being done.
Catherine, I can understand that response. Your poetry is striking, it's beautiful, and it's also moving. And I want to thank you for sharing your work with us here today at Delmarva Public Radio, Writer's Edition. And thank you for the work you're doing with the patients in the hospitals. It sounds incredibly beneficial. Also, I want to thank our listeners for participating today as well. Thank you. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.
Thank you, Harold.